Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
This is Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. I'm Jan van der Made in Paris. This week, Swedish teenagers take a stand against the CIA's secret prison flights to the Guantanamo Bay detention center.
They are taking people and transporting them to other countries known for their treatment against the prisoners.
No matter where you go in Europe, books on the Holocaust always whip up controversy. Now a Polish historian says his countrymen had a hand in it.
I agree with this argument that Poles had their share in the Holocaust and that Polish peasants took part in the murder of Jews. I agree that anti-Semitism was a kind of cultural code.
And more from the war, the German government wants to erect a permanent exhibition describing the fate of German war victims.
No country in the world remembers the Nazi victims like Germany. The problem lies at the Polish side of the border, because Poland doesn't want to recognize its own role in the war. The expulsion was a crime, and she wants that to be acknowledged.
Tut uns leid, was wir gemacht haben, es war verkehrt.
All those and other stories from right across Europe, as well as a wholesome digest of everything you need to know from Brussels this week in our weekly Brussels briefing. Plus, of course, a reminder of this month's quiz. We have had an impressive response so far, but keep them coming. First we go to Spain. Spain's abortion law is coming under close scrutiny, where the government says it is prepared to consider changing the legislation if it can achieve a wide political and social consensus. The announcement follows women from a feminist collective reporting themselves to police for illegal abortions in order to draw attention to what they see as the failings of the law. Private abortion clinics have also been on a week-long strike to protest against the law they say doesn't protect medical practitioners or the women who have abortions. The strike was a response to a recent series of police raids on abortion clinics accused of carrying out illegal terminations. From Madrid, Deutsche Welle's Danny Wood reports.
Abortion is a controversial issue, especially in Spain, where a large minority of Spaniards, many of them Roman Catholics, if not strongly against, are very doubtful about legal abortion. At the Dator Clinic in Madrid, Luisa Torres is the social worker who advises women who are deciding what to do about an unplanned pregnancy.
Yo no he ocultado nunca lo que hago.
I have never hidden what I do, and I think that family and friends have always had a profound respect for what I do. I don't defend abortion per se. What I defend is the right of women to choose.
Luisa Torres remembers the days back in the late 1970s when she would escort women to Britain and Germany for abortions because it was illegal in Spain. In 1985, the law was changed to allow abortions under certain circumstances during the first 12 weeks in cases of rape, within the first 22 weeks if there is a risk of fetal abnormalities. But most abortions in Spain are carried out after a doctor diagnoses a woman's pregnancy as a risk to her physical or mental health. The doctor's judgment can be called into question by the authorities, and in recent months, more than a dozen medical staff have been arrested on suspicion of carrying out illegal abortions. Spanish doctors want the law changed in line with other European countries, where a woman can choose to have a termination within the first 3 months of a pregnancy. Dr. Rolando Ladea runs a private abortion clinic in Madrid.
We are now on 2008, and the law was made in 1985. Society has changed a lot. I think abortion should be free, depending on the woman that is pregnant, nothing else.
Medical practitioners like Dr. Ladea recently went on a week-long strike to draw attention to the fact that the current law can be used against them. Private abortion clinics perform more than 90% of Spain's legal abortions, and following police raids on clinics in Barcelona and Madrid, doctors say they're being criminalized for doing their job. But many Spaniards, while not against abortion, are concerned that during the last decade, the number of legal abortions in Spain has doubled to more than 100,000 per year. And recently a doctor was secretly filmed by a television crew, apparently offering to perform an unlawful abortion on an undercover journalist in her 8th month of pregnancy. That documentary raised the alarm with anti-abortion groups in Spain, who, supported by some sections of the Roman Catholic Church, have stepped up their campaigns, denouncing clinics to the authorities. Juan Sanchez Galera is a spokesperson for the group Life Matters. They defend the right to life from the moment of conception and if it's not possible to illegalize abortion, they at least want to stop late terminations and have tighter regulations for private clinics.
The abortion procedures have become very, very extreme. We've demonstrated that abortions of 7, 8, even 9 months are being undertaken. So one of our aims is to humanize this where possible, and above all, to find alternatives for those women who feel obligated to have abortions because they don't have another option.
Life Matters doesn't want the law changed to allow a woman to freely decide to have an abortion. They argue that would be like legalizing murder. In another twist in this complicated moral debate, members of a feminist group have reported themselves to the police for having illegal abortions. They're very worried that the police investigations into abortion clinics have led to about 30 women who had terminations being questioned by a judge. Like the striking abortion clinics, these feminists want to draw attention to how the current law can criminalize doctors and women. In the face of this public debate, the national government says it will consider changing the legislation if it can achieve broad political and social consensus. Given the fundamental divisions between both sides of this moral issue, changing the law will be very difficult. Danny Wood, Deutsche Welle Radio, Madrid.
Staying with the issue of national identity now, but from a rather different angle. The Second World War is high on the agenda again in Germany, but this time not because of German war crimes, but instead because of German war victims. The millions of Germans that were expelled from the territories the country lost to Poland and Russia. The German government wants to erect a visible sign or a permanent exhibition describing their fate. The proposal has sparked a fierce debate with neighboring Poland. Radio Netherlands worldwide correspondent Lawrence Boven spoke with Hertha Marlow, an elderly woman from Berlin, who experienced the expulsion as a young woman.
Ja, das ist mein Geburtshaus. So sieht das jetzt aus. Es war mal ein sehr schönes Ziegeldach.
Hertha Marlow shows me the pictures of the house where she was born. It's a farmhouse in the village of Schmiedenberg in West Prussia, in the area that Germany was forced to give back to Poland when it lost the First World War. German population was expelled after the Second World War. Hertha Marlow was also expelled after the war and grew up in East Germany. Nobody knows exactly how many Germans were expelled from their homes in 1945. Estimates range from 12 to 18 million people. They came from the areas Germany lost to Poland, but also from ethnically German areas that existed for centuries all over Eastern Europe. Around 2 million people died in the expulsion, which some Germans have even called the biggest ethnic cleansing in history. More than 60 years after the war, the German government now wants to create a permanent exhibition center to remember their fate.
Es ist ein Teil unserer Geschichte und wir erinnern an viele Facetten unserer Geschichte in unterschiedlichen Museen.
Erika Steinbach, she's a member of the German Parliament for the governing Christian Democratic Party. She's also the president of the Federation of Expellees. In her view, the German history is incomplete without a museum that tells the story of the expelled. But Ms. Steinbach's ideas have sparked a fierce debate with neighboring Poland. The Poles are distrustful of the planned exhibition. Even the new Polish Prime Minister, generally seen as a liberal, has warned the Germans not to change the hierarchy of guilt. He stresses that first there was the Nazi campaign of terror that killed millions of Poles, and then the expulsion. He is afraid that if attention is drawn to German war victims, this will push German crimes to the background. But that is nonsense, according to Steinbach.
Ich glaube, es gibt kaum ein Land auf der Welt, das sich so bewusst seiner Verantwortung stellt.
No country in the world remembers the Nazi victims like Germany, Steinbach tells me. She says the problem lies at the Polish side of the border, because Poland doesn't want to recognize its own role in the war. The expulsion was a crime, and she wants that to be acknowledged.
Es tut uns leid, was wir gemacht haben, es war verkehrt.
Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk has made a counter-proposal. Instead of a new museum for the expelled in Berlin, an international museum about the Second World War should be built in Gdansk. Mr. Tusk says the fate of the expelled can be presented in what he considers the proper context, that of Germany's war crimes. It's hard to see how the German plans can go ahead without at least the silent approval of Poland. German Chancellor Angela Merkel will have to work hard to sell the idea to her Polish counterpart. In the coming weeks, she'll send a special delegation to Warsaw to press home her good intentions. For Hertha Marlow, it's clear the museum should be built.
Ich finde ja, dass Ich habe nie verstanden, für was ich da büßen muss und für...
She never understood why she had been punished for the crimes of others. Nobody in her family supported the war, she says. But in war there are losses on both sides. Why should only one side be allowed to remember?
Kann man doch nicht bloß die einen beklagen, die anderen nicht. Jede Mutter weint doch um ihren Mann, um ihr Kind.
That report from Lawrence Boven. And we haven't finished with the war yet. Not for the first time in recent memory, there is controversy in Poland on a World War II issue. Two books on Polish-Jewish relations after the war have just been published, both by Polish-born historians living in the United States. Michael Kubicki of Polish Radio's External Service looks at why the books are set to provoke heated debate on one of the most complex chapters in Poland's modern history.
The books in question are Fear, Antisemitism in Poland After Auschwitz by Jan Tomasz Gross, former professor at Princeton University, and After the Holocaust, Polish-Jewish Conflict in the Wake of World War II by Marek Jan Chodakiewicz, dean at the Institute of World Politics in Washington. Gross is far better known to the Polish public. Several years ago, his Neighbors, a book about the 1941 massacre of Jews by the Polish inhabitants of Jedwabne, provoked a debate which led to a reappraisal of history written under Poland's communist regime. It showed that the image of Poles being only the heroes and martyrs of the war was not true. Gross's new book, Fear, focuses on the 1946 Kielce pogrom in which 40 Jews were killed.
A Jew was looked upon as a threat for various reasons. He could claim the right to someone's property. He also brought back the memories of various terrible things and crimes in which many people were involved during the occupation. Anti-Semitic actions enjoyed acceptance of broad sections of Polish society. Those responsible for them have not been condemned by the local communities until today.
In Fear, Gross writes about what he describes as Polish society's violently expressed desire to render the country free of Jews. He declared that he wanted his book to act as a shock therapy. Professor Chodakiewicz says that a historian's goal should rather be to reconstruct the truth about the events under study. His own extensive research led him to conclude that most Jews who were killed in post-war Poland were not the victims of anti-Semitism. He stresses that Polish-Jewish relations in the 1940s should be examined in the context of the Soviet-imposed communist dictatorship.
Whoever had been despoiled by the Nazis and the communists should have had his or her property restored. That goes both for the Christians and the Jews. That didn't happen because of the communist hostility toward private property. Therefore, there were conflicts over property, which only the communists could have solved. Also, the communists entirely destroyed the machinery of the Polish state. When the communists pushed the Nazis out of Poland, they started shooting, arresting, and deporting functionaries of Free Poland. That also means the police and the judiciary of the underground. That means there was no law and order. When there's no law and order, banditry is rampant.
The debate on the two books have only just started in the Polish media and the academic circles. For historian Marcin Zaremba of Warsaw University, Gross's Fear is a very important publication.
I agree with this argument that Poles had their share in the Holocaust and that Polish peasants took part in the murder of Jews in Jedwabne, Radziwów, the regions of Łomża, Zamość and Kielce. I agree that anti-Semitism was a kind of cultural code which Poles used at that time, and that Jews were not responsible for the introduction of communist rule in Poland.
Many Polish historians recognize the positive aspects of Gross's book, but argue that the author's strong language makes serious debate extremely difficult. Polish prosecutors launched a probe against Gross under a section of a criminal code providing for a 3 years prison term for anyone publicly accusing the Polish nation of participating in, organizing, or being responsible for Nazi or communist crimes. Both the admirers and critics of the book agree that this is a wrong decision. A prominent Polish bishop said, books should be read and discussed, and those of poor quality simply ignored. I'm Michał Kubicki for Network Europe.
While Poland and Germany try to get to grips with their pasts, the United States seems intent on creating its own present-day controversy. The concept of rendition flights has appeared in our headlines in the last couple of years. Terror suspects flown secretly through different countries' airspaces and interrogated in secret locations. Human rights groups have complained bitterly that the practice is illegal on a number of levels. Sweden has produced its own negative headlines in relation to the alleged CIA flights. But, as Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller now reports, there are some Swedish teenagers currently trying to draw attention to the problem in their very own way.
God eftermiddag och välkomna till den här resan igen som ska ta oss till Stockholm Arlanda. Och flygtiden idag blir 55 minuter.
The normal sounds of an outward-bound airliner and of the friendly crew welcoming you aboard, providing safety instructions, length of flights, temperatures and more. A far cry from some highly condemned flights these days, crisscrossing not only this continent, sometimes from secret destinations in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East, or back and forth to the notorious Guantanamo prison camp at the American military base on Cuba. International human rights organizations and a European Union report have sharply criticized these secret flights, fetching and delivering prisoners to jails where torture is expected to be a standard part of interrogation, and where these flights move human traffic from one place to another in what can be years-long detention without trial or where evidence against the suspects is never produced. The accusations against the CIA and other intelligence services using these covert air flights often make big headlines and then fade quickly. Away. However, some 17-year-olds who are members of the Swedish branch of the worldwide human rights organization Amnesty International want to keep these covert journeys in the spotlight and are dedicating some of the time most teenagers devote to after-school activities or party-going to very special public relations work at schools and public spaces and at downtown exhibition centers. They're wearing bright yellow uniforms at times, offering seating on their make-believe airline torture tours.
Seat backs must be raised and tables folded before takeoff and landing. So would you please fasten your seat belts and keep them fastened whenever you're seated. I wish you a nice flight and tours. Stop on.
My name is Dia Arnfeldt.
And?
Linda Isaksson.
Wearing yellow shirts with air torture logos on it.
Well, this is a campaign with Amnesty. We are campaigning against the torture in the world and the so-called renditions. They are taking people and transporting them to other countries known for their treatment against the prisoners.
Alleged terrorists, people who are accused terrorists, but sometimes no evidence at all.
Exactly, that's just it. And that's the campaign is against that, because we want to make a protest to the unethical treatment against these people, because there is no proof. And that's why we are standing here today.
What kind of petitions are you making?
Well, it's just the names on a piece of paper, and then we send the letters to Condoleezza Rice, for example, to make a difference in the world.
How old are you now?
17. Me too, 17.
The young Swedish torture tour campaigners, Swedish Amnesty itself and others are quick to point out that these secret undercover flights are not just something that happens far from the borders of this neutral Nordic nation. Swedish government officials have been repeatedly blasted for permitting CIA agents to land their hired plane here in Stockholm and remove two Egyptian refugees from Swedish territory, stripping them, drugging them, and roughing them up on board the plane in front of uncritical Swedish military, and then delivering them into Cairo, where they claim they were tortured in the Egyptian prison. Despite protests from Amnesty and others, one of the men released from his Cairo jail with no charges against him has been denied permission to return to Sweden by the present government here. And a Swede finally released from the Guantanamo prison with no charges ever presented against him has lost his attempt to get any compensation for the years of detention on the island.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can't forget, we are now over the province of Skåne in Sweden. And on your
You're listening to Network Europe. Now for some more juicy news, we have a look at the ongoing story about the French president and his new partner, former singer and model Carla Bruni.
Quatre consonnes et trois voyelles, c'est le prénom de Raphaël. Je le murmure à mon oreille et chaque lettre m'émerveille. C'est le tréma qui m'ensorcelle dans le prénom de Raphaël. Comme il se mêle au A, au E, comme il les entremêle au L, Raphaël.
That's the song called Raphaël, penned and performed by model-turned-singer Carla Bruni. Bruni's songs are no doubt gaining more airplay on French radio now that she's the new girlfriend of French President Nicolas Sarkozy. And I guess we'll have to wait and see if Carla Bruni pens a song called Nicolas. After becoming the first French president to divorce during his time in office, Nicolas Sarkozy looks set to become the first to marry as well. He certainly is keen to keep himself busy. This week he described his relationship with Carla Bruni as serious and hinted that a wedding, perhaps in secret, could be expected soon. Our Paris correspondent John Lawrenson says if Carla Bruni becomes Carla Sarkozy, it would revolutionize the role of France's first lady and mark a victory for a certain sort of women's lib.
So, if the French press have it right, Nicolas Sarkozy and Carla Bruni will be married in time for the Valentine's Day cover of Paris Match in February. Fast work. But then Sarkozy knows it doesn't do to have a French leader without at least one woman in his life. Ever since the ancient kings of France, French leaders have been expected to show their vitality in this domain. To entertain, albeit discreetly, large numbers of mistresses was considered a sign that one was fit to rule a large number of subjects. Henry IV, for example, was known as Le Vert Galant, an image evoking sap rising in the wood. As for Carla Bruni, her fame had been waning, but even a star on the wane has more razzmatazz than the usual premier dame, brought up in a convent to serve her husband and raise money for muscular dystrophy. Should she become Madame Sarkozy, the Élysée Palace would be transformed. Someone as successful, confident and at ease in the public eye as Carla Bruni would be far less likely to put up with it all were she to become Madame Sarkozy. For a start, she's quite a lot bigger than him. But above all, Carla Bruni would bring a very strong idea of liberty to the Élysée Palace. The sexual conquests of this self-confessed man-eater are truly impressive. The newspapers usually list the most famous, Mick Jagger, England's glory, who definitely deserves an OBE for an outstanding shagging career, is always first. But then you've got a tremendous list of stars from France and the entire world. When Sarkozy first made his affair with Carla Bruni public, there was much supposing that here was a man on the rebound, reasserting his self-esteem with a trophy girlfriend. But who is the trophy of whom? Carla Bruni has more trophies in her cupboard than even the most philandering French leaders of old. She is perhaps French womanhood's just revenge. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Now we stay in France for some more serious news. Last Wednesday, the French oil company Total was ordered to pay its share of nearly $200 million in damages for a 1999 oil spill off the northwest coast of France. The Erika oil tanker broke in half in December of 1999, spilling almost 20,000 tons of crude oil into the sea, which killed hundreds of thousands of berths along 400 kilometers of coastline. Radio France International's Sarah Elsass was at the courtroom in Paris for the verdict.
The opening bell in the courtroom, which was packed with lawyers and spectators. The judge spent almost 2 hours reading out charges and the decisions against the 15 defendants who had spent 4 months in court last summer. The judge exonerated the ship's crew as well as the French Maritime Authority, which had been accused of not reacting quickly enough to the disaster. He named four entities responsible for the spill: the ship's owner, its manager, the certification company RINA, and Total. The judge said the owner and manager were responsible for skimping on repairs of the 23-year-old ship that was to carry highly polluting crude oil. RINA's inspections and Total's vetting process allowed the ship to go through. The judge read out the fines to the defendant standing in front of him: €375,000 for the two companies and €75,000 for the two individuals. But that wasn't all. The judge then started reading out individual reparations payments. Those ended up totaling €192 million. Those were requested by the 101 plaintiffs who claimed to have suffered from the oil spill.
It's just little people who works in the sea, who work on the beach, and really people who don't have a lot of money and who lost everything.
That's Emmanuel Rigler, a lawyer who represented some of the claims. Emmanuel Ludot represented small businessmen along the coast and said many of his clients didn't even come to court because they were convinced they'd get nothing.
Une société qu'ils appellent Rando Balade, par exemple, dont l'activité est une activité de gestion du tourisme local.
He gives one example, a tourism company that received some money from the international fund set up to compensate victims of oil spills, but it wasn't enough. The Erica decision, he says, allows people like them to get their lives up and running again. His clients got around 5,000 or 7,000 euros each. The IOPC, or International Oil Pollution Compensation Funds, give money to victims who suffer damage from oil spills. Cities got reparations for things like image damages, also for their share of the cleanup operations, buying shovels and buckets. But they didn't get environmental damages. Those went to bigger entities, like the regions and departments. The judge deemed them responsible for the environment, not cities. Yannick Jadot, who runs Greenpeace France, says he's very happy with the decision, but it didn't go quite far enough on the environmental front.
The ecological prejudice has not been recognized in the law. So we are still in some confusion about that type of, you know, how do we somehow pay for a bird which has been killed, you know?
Do you think birds should have rights in the French law?
I don't know if birds should have rights, but when you kill a bird, I mean, somehow you should have to pay for that. And what we think is that this new type of rights, this new type of law, should be developed probably at the international level because it's a new type of right.
Greenpeace was awarded 30,000 euros of the reparations. Total, which maintained its innocence throughout the trial, has not said whether or not it will appeal the decision. A lawyer said he'd advise the company to do so. A spokesman said they'd study it. For Network Europe, I'm Sarah Elzis in Paris.
Coming up shortly, I'll be reminding you of this month's quiz competition, but first we turn our attention to Brussels, where our correspondent Quentin Dickinson told me a short while ago what our European policymakers have been up to in our names this week. Quentin, this week we've had deliberations of the European Parliament and some interesting speakers. Let's first go to the deliberations. The consumer credit law was approved by the European Parliament on Wednesday. The law means that consumers will now be able to shop around for the best offer from banks and credit companies in other EU countries. Can we see this as a core document guaranteeing the benefits of the common market? And what does the law mean in practice?
Well, this was, of course, one of the major events this month. This is the monthly meeting in Strasbourg of the European Parliament. And as you rightly indicated, the consumer credit law was one of the major assets of this week. Now, this means, as you said, that one can shop around and find the best deal for one's personal credit. On the other hand, of course, there is a compromise around this, and banks will now be able to charge borrowers who reimburse the total amount borrowed before the end of the credit period which was agreed upon. This was unheard of in a certain number of countries like France, and anticipated reimbursements usually thought to be offset by a better risk. But in this case, of course, consumers will be penalized if the banks decide to avail themselves of this possibility. But there again, this is a compromise, and this is what Europe is about.
Now, one discussion being held this week was the one on a European policy towards the Roma. They call them the gens de voyage here, the traveling people. They're gypsies camping out in caravans, often to the dismay of people living in the communities where they settle down. We've had expulsions here in France and Italy. There have been incidents resulting in mass expulsions of Roma people as well. And they were sent back to Romania, where they're not really welcome either. What came out of the discussion on a common European policy on the Roma?
Well, the woolly thinking about the Roma people, if you'd like to call them that way, is of course already expressed by the fact that nobody really knows what to call them. And on the other hand, most people think that they spend their time traveling around, whereas most of them in reality in Central and Eastern Europe are entirely set in one given village or city. They're no longer traveling around in horse-drawn carts. The European Parliament over the years has been considerably concerned by the situation or the plight, if you will, of the Roma people. This often overshadowed the enlargement negotiations with Romania, since Romania has the largest population of Roma, in the sense that many of the very numerous orphans in Romania are, in effect, of Roma origin. Now, the concern in European circles for the fate of the Roma people is in marked contrast with the lack of interest, as you indicated, shown by the Romanian authorities, even in the case of the standoff with the Italian government about the murder of an Italian citizen by young Roma illegal immigrant, as it happened. To be quite clear, the European Parliament and Europe in general has no real means of pressure on the Romanian authorities to do anything, and the objectives are, of course, unclear, other than what one might term a general expression of compassion for the underprivileged, but this doesn't take us very far.
That was our Brussels correspondent, Quentin Dickinson. Before we sign off, do take part in this month's quiz. This month we are looking for the name of a French composer whose birth 100 years ago is being celebrated in 2008.
He was organist in the church, La Trinité, in Paris. He composed a lot of pieces too for organ, and I think it's the more important composers in terms of organ in the 20th century.
So who is this man? We already know he's a composer who had synesthesia, a condition where a person literally hears colors. He is also a very religious man. If you know the answer, send it to contact@networkeurope.org. Include your name and where you listen to Network Europe. And to end, some music. This week we've chosen the Spanish anthem. Criticism on proposed lyrics were so strong that the text was rejected this week. So the anthem will, for the time being, remain a wordless one. Well, for details on previous and future programs, check our website at www.networkeurope.org with Network Europe written as one word. Many thanks to production assistant Joanna Labetz. Don't forget to tune in same time next week. And from me, Jan van der Made, and from all of our partners across the continent, goodbye.